Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. It's May 11th, and I'm doing something I've wanted to do for a long time. I'm joined by one of my, about my favorite people in the world, Dr. Mark Skidmore, professor at Michigan State University, and expert on the missing money. And the title of our Soleri Report tonight is The Financial Coup d'Etat, Missing Money for Beginners. We have just done a glorious update to the Missing Money website at missingmoney.soleri.com. And as many of you know, this is money disappearing from the federal government is something that we've been covering literally since 1998. The topic has grown with the amount of money missing grown. And there's been a lot of people interested in understanding this as part of the going direct research at reset and the changes in the financial system underway. So we thought it was appropriate that we do an overview for you. So a missing money for beginners, and nobody better in the world to explain all of this than Dr. Mark Skidmore. So Dr. Skidmore, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Catherine. It's always great to talk with you, and always super interesting.
So I met you it was after the fiscal 2015 books were published. So it was, I think it was 2016 or early 2017. And I was talking about the extraordinary amount of money that went missing in 2015. And you had the integrity to say, that doesn't sound right, and go look it up. And when you discovered that the numbers were right, you called me and said, what can I do to help? The next thing you know, you ended up doing a survey with your students. And I had the missing money up to $12 trillion. You got it all the way to $21 trillion. And you did a report in 2017. But the thing I remember the first time I met you in person, and I'd been on this journey for, 20 years in grappling with trying to tell people. It's like trying to tell people that, the moon is not made of cheese. When when their parents promised them as a little child that, so you've got to tell them that their reality is very different than they think it is. And it's a progression as when I first started to deal with money going missing from the U.S. government, I would bump into all the different lies and pushback you get. And I remember meeting you and realizing, he's going to have to go through that too.
It's a bit of a journey.
Yeah, it is a journey. So maybe if you could say a few words about what got you interested and what the journey's been like to you as a person.
Sure. So I guess my worldview started to shift during the financial crisis that began in 2007, 2008. When everything kind of blew up and then it spilled over into the real estate market and everything went really, it looked like we were teetering on some sort of financial collapse and major decisions had to be made. And then when things started to settle down, I remember Eric Holder came on TV and I remember watching it and he said something to the effect of, we recognize that a lot of what has happened was a result of corruption and illegal activities, but we're not going to prosecute anyone.
And, it's quite extraordinary.
Yeah. And it gave up some lame excuse like, well, if we did that, the whole system would be in question and these entities are too big to fail, which is totally false. It was like the little thing in the back of my mind clicked. And I thought, the world does not work the way I think it works. I'm an economist, so every person has a model of how the world works. And so economists sometimes have explicit model, they're mathematical models that try to mimic behavior and help us understand what's going on. But anyway, the idea of a model, we all have models and we filter the world through those models. And if something doesn't fit into our worldview or our model, we kind of toss it to the side. We say, well, that's an anomaly, an irrelevant thing that happened, but oh, well, it doesn't change your worldview. And this changed my worldview. I thought, you know what? My model's wrong.
Right.
I have to figure this out. And I was very fortunate because I had an opportunity to go on sabbatical, which afforded me the opportunity to actually start looking and to look in new areas and try to find answers to questions, and realizing that there were a whole lot of anomalies that didn't fit into my worldview. And right. So I needed a new worldview. And that's a very difficult process to go through. So you caught me in the middle of that. I was listening to a talk, I think, that you were giving. I think it was on Greg Hunter. I don't remember for sure. But you had mentioned the 2015 Office of the Inspector General report for the Army. And at the time, I think the Army had roughly 150 to $200 billion budget. And you said that it had over $6 trillion in unsupported adjustments. Well, I have some background in accounting and public budgeting. And I thought that is impossible. You can't have $6 trillion of unsupported, transactions, because that would have, it's just unheard of. It doesn't make any sense. And so I thought you made a mistake. And right. So I thought, well, I'm going to go find the report. And so I looked it up, and it, sure enough, it said over $6 trillion. And that's what prompted me to contact you. And I sent you an email. You responded. And so we decided to work together and sort through the whatever existing reports we could find and right. just tally it up.
Right. So let's go back. Let me do a little bit of history. If you look at the way the federal government works, you have the taxes collected by come into Treasury. So you have a fiscal side of the house, which is run by Treasury, but essentially overseen by the Congress. And then you have a monetary side of the house, which is run by the private New York Fed member or the private Federal Reserve Bank. So you have 12 Federal Reserve Banks that are sort of umbrellaed up by a board of governors in Washington, which is a bit of a hybrid. So you have the monetary side of the house, and then you have the fiscal side of the house. So the banks on one side and the Treasury and the Congress on the other side. And essentially those two groups run the U.S. federal mechanism. Now, they're very tied in because it's a global economy with the central banks around the world. And one of the most important things I think that happened to lead to what I call the financial coup starting in fiscal 1998, so October 1997, was the New York Fed and the Federal Reserve finally became shareholders in the Bank of International Settlements. And the Bank of International Settlements enjoys sovereign immunity and has a committee that oversees what's called the systemically important institutions, banks, insurance companies, and payment systems, which, interestingly enough, we saw Eric Holder give essentially a legal pass to their criminal behavior during the financial crisis. And so one of the challenges we've got is we've got a central banking system which is running monetary policy and portions of which are either engaged in criminal activities or take the position that they are above the law. In other words, we have to obey the law, but they yeah. don't. And you can imagine that is a formula for a lot of shenanigans. I first became aware of what I call the financial coup in April 1997. I was making a presentation to a group of the largest pension funds in the country, and the president of the largest pension fund, I was basically saying we can re-engineer the federal budget using new technology in a way that will be wonderful for communities, and we can pay down our debt, and the middle class can be successful despite globalization. And he looked at me and he said, "You don't understand, it's too late. They've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out starting in the fall." And I thought he meant we're reallocating the equity investments in the pension funds to the emerging markets. I didn't begin to realize he meant, no, we're stealing you know, we're stealing a lot of money out of the federal government. And it was that fall that the fiscal year began when money started to disappear. And I should just mention there was an effort in the first Bush administration to put together financial reforms so that agencies had to publish audited financial statements every year. And it was when those statements began being published and admitting that they couldn't produce audited financial statements that we would get these reports of undocumentable adjustments. And the reasons why they say they couldn't produce audited financial statements. And so you, when you came in and said, okay, I and my students are going to do a survey, what you did was you did a survey of two of the agencies, DOD being the big one, the Department of Defense, where there's $20 trillion missing, and HUD, where there's $1 trillion. And you and your students looked at all the financial statements from 1998 through 2000, I guess it was 2016.
Yeah.
And tell us what you found.
Well, so we didn't find a report for every year, and we didn't find a report for every entity in HUD or DOD. And sometimes it was an overall for the all of DOD, sometimes for Army or Navy or Air Force. And in those reports, you could find summaries of what they found. And these discrepancies that you're talking about aren't uncommon generally in any kind of financial statement, because there are always expenditures that you can't verify, right, or a transaction that you don't have a receipt for. As an illustration, I was talking with a friend of mine who was an accountant for a major firm, and she said, well, in my arena, if there was an expenditure of more than about $50 that we couldn't account for, we would go track it down and try to find a receipt. So out of, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars, that's the way a firm would typically operate. And that's the way we operate at the university, right? If I have an expenditure, I'm traveling and I get a reimbursement, or if I have a grant with the federal government, we really need to document what we spent the money on and why and what, right, the outcome was, et cetera. And my experience with the grants and et cetera is that they're very careful. So how can you get, you know, if you're thinking about an entity that tracks down a receipt for a $50 expense, and how can you get, you know, literally hundreds of billions of dollars in a single transaction that is an unaccounted for? And
I just want to stop you for a second.
Yeah.
If you look at the laws related to financial management by the federal government using taxpayers' money, so this is taxpayers' money or taxpayers' credit, you have the Constitution is the most senior law. Then you have legislative laws passed, and then you have regulations, and then you have administrative policies. So they're kind of four levels. But if you go to the top level, the Constitution says two things. One is nothing should be spent unless it's been appropriated in a budget.
Right.
Congress has to appropriate and the executive branch has to adopt. So, you know, that appropriation budget has to be essentially signed into law. So part of this spending process is to make sure that you're not spending money that hasn't been approved in the budget process by Congress and the executive branch. So one is that, and the second is you're required to disclose it. So after you've spent the money that has been approved, you're supposed to disclose how you spent the money. So what you're describing is in complete violation of both of these.
A complete violation of both. And what would happen is somebody would do their job and they would indicate the discrepancy or the transaction that couldn't be accounted for. And then people would say, oh, well, and there would be no follow-up, no accounting, no searching, looking for, you know, some sort of reason for it. It was just noted that there was this discrepancy, and then we would move on. And it just got to the point of absurdity, you know, when you have $6 trillion for the Army's, on an annual budget of roughly $200 billion or something like that. it's nonsensical. So then you have to ask the question, well, why doesn't anybody actually follow up, and why isn't it fixed, and why don't we develop, we could talk about all of the excuses for why this never gets fixed, right?
There's like a whole manual of 1,000 pages of all the excuses.
Yeah.
You know, and every time we go through this cycle, which we've gone through many times since 1990, they run you through all the excuses. And I really enjoyed watching you go through the cycle of excuses the first time.
And, you know, well, anyway, so the excuses range from, well, we don't have the technological updates or the ability to update, or we're not competent. That would be the most common general excuses, that we just don't know what we're doing. And it doesn't pass the smell test. And so then you have to start thinking, well, why is this happening? And and then that opens up a whole can of worms. And so you've been trying to look at that can of worms for a long time. So
if I have a private company and I'm breaking the laws related to how I'm supposed to manage money, you know, either my bank will shut me down and not affect transactions, or, because the bank will say, look, the transactions you're trying to make are illegal. You're stealing shareholders' money. We won't affect the transactions. Or the stock exchange will shut you down. They won't let your stock trade. But if you look at the U.S. government, they are able to continue to issue securities, and they are able to continue to have the bank account affect transactions. Because if there's $21 trillion of undocumentable adjustments, and that relates to a large amount of unreported transactions, it was the New York Fed member banks that were making those transactions. They're the depository.
Yeah, right. The Federal Reserve is the fiscal agent for the government. Right. So all transactions flow through the Federal Reserve.
Right.
So if we wanted to know the nature of those transactions, the Federal Reserve has the ability to show us what they were.
Although I would point out that shortly after we published your 2017 report on the missing money, there was a fire on a Saturday night at the New York Fed. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember that.
It turns out the New York Post reported that somebody was using a fireplace in the basement on a Saturday night, on, I would say, in October, which was pretty warm, you know, so very interesting.
Lots of interesting things happened during that time. There was that event. There was the case which astounded you and me, but it was a report, I think, that came out in 2018 for the Navy. And after we had sort of documented all of the discrepancies and accounting adjustments that tallied at $21 trillion, the Office of the Inspector General appeared to be reticent to publish yet another one. And so they decided to publish it, but it had been fully redacted. Right. Everything was X'd out in black. So they published the report, but you couldn't see any numbers at all.
But they redacted the title too. Remember?
They redacted the title. Yeah,
and I was. You sent me the report and you said, "Can this happen?" And I said, "I didn't know that it could. I've never seen it. I've never seen this before. I've never seen in a financial report every number and the title. I did not know it could happen." One of my favorite ones, though, was I was very adamant when we published your report. And if you go to missingmoney.solari.com, which is sort of our website on this topic, when we put up your report, I was insistent that we had to have copies of all the financials from DOD and HUD racked up by year, and we needed to have them on multiple servers around the world. And I was concerned that they would take all the documents down and we'd be able, you know, we linked to their documents, but in the worst case, I wanted to be able to get the documents up.
I just have to say that I thought you were being overly cautious.
Yes, I remember saying to a member of our team that he thinks I'm, Dr. Skidmore thinks I'm being, I don't think I said overly cautious. I might have said paranoid. And then lo and behold, tell everybody what happened.
All of the links were disabled. We couldn't access any of the reports. And it was sort of an interesting development, because thankfully you followed your instincts reposted in your own server all of the reports.
Right.
So that was good. They didn't go away, but all the original links were disabled. And then they were gone for a while. And then they were put back up later under a new link. And it's not clear, you know, when I asked about it, they said, oh, well, we just had a new server. So that's why they were taken down and put back up.
So the one thing I will tell you is HUD and DOD took them down together at the same time.
Yeah.
And if you look at the judicial coordination between HUD and DOD, I would tell you that is impossible.
Yeah, they're totally different structures,
right.
You know, within
them. Right.
So
right.
I would agree, impossible that they would have done that exactly at the same time. So it's just a whole set of unusual things. And then, of course, it culminated in Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board Standard 56. And I don't know if you want to talk about that yet.
Yeah, so let me say, we, at one point, to help, I'm a great believer that one of our jobs at Solari is to digest and report on some pretty complex stuff to help other reporters cover it quickly. So we're trying to take the time it takes a seasoned reporter to get their arms around a topic, you know, from 1 year down to a week. And one of the things we did was we had two wonderful attorneys in California write 7 briefing papers on all the financial laws of the United States. So there's one paper on monetary laws and sort of the monetary structure, and then 6 papers on the fiscal sort of side of the house and how things are supposed to work. Anyway, and what's remarkable is I think the financial management laws of the U.S. government are quite excellent, you know, and I have a prejudice because there was a whole group of us in the Bush administration who worked to supplement and add to them, but they are quite good. And in fact, if you ran a government according to those laws, it would work quite well. Sometimes when this happens, people say, we need a new law. No, we don't need a new law. We just need to enforce the ones we have. Anyway, but I do want to mention that those are available at the website, and you can really go to town and learn everything you ever wanted to know about the federal finances. But one of the extraordinary things that happened after Dr. Skidmore published his first study was the House and Senate and executive branch got together and adopted an administrative rule related to the federal finances and took the position that this administrative policy superseded the Constitution, the financial management laws, and the regulations. This is sort of a financial coup on the just do it method by administrative policy. And it was called Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board Statement 56. So why don't you go ahead and explain, while we all thought that we were interested in Kavanaugh's sex life and the Supreme Court testimony and hearings, yeah, in October 2018, the financial coup was basically everybody in Washington was getting together and agreeing on the next step in the financial coup. So tell us all about it.
Well, so the first thing to take note of is whenever something real, seemingly really big and shiny is happening over here and drawing our attention, sometimes that's a real thing and we should be paying attention. But sometimes it's a distraction so that something else can be happening over here that isn't drawing our attention. And in this case, it seems like a very boring accounting, you know, procedural change, but it was huge.
Right.
In summary, which you can read about on the Missing Money website, the recommendation by the board was that a small set of people, and we're not allowed to know who has the authority to do this or to have access, has the ability to create two sets of books from this point forward. And there's a real set of books that remains hidden and only accessible to this small set of people. But if that small group of people believes that it's a national security issue, they have the ability to modify the books essentially in any way that they want, and report those to the public. And they've given themselves the authority to do that without even indicating that those books had been modified. So from that point on, you know, when I talk about the federal financial statements, I have no idea what they mean. I haven't paid attention to the financial statements in any significant detail since then, because I know that a small group of people is modifying them in ways that I can't know how, and or even if they did it. And so that was the culmination of all of this, which obviously that wasn't the hoped for outcome, but it makes it clear that, right. You know, I mean, at the end of all of this, if you have that kind of world in which a small group of people can do that with your tax dollars and other kinds of funds, then do you really have a representative democracy?
No, and you don't have a constitutional government.
You don't have a constitutional government.
Right.
And so that's a you know, the world in which we live. There's another layer to this, of course, in that select people can also exempt financial reporting within corporations as well if it's deemed to be a national security issue. Right. So you end up with, you know, go ahead.
Well, with if you take FASB 56 combined with the classification laws, you know, that allow you to, you know, the national security director to waive SEC requirements by the big companies doing business with the government. Basically, what you're doing is you're taking the majority of the U.S. securities market, bonds and stocks, and saying there's no real financial disclosure.
And the parameters around both of those things are wide open. You know, the Standard 56, it's not like for national defense only, DOD. Mm-hmm. It's every agency within the government can be modified. And similarly, you would think, you know, maybe the financial statements on the business side, the corporate side, might be modified only for defense-related contracts. Not so. It is wide open. You could anything. Right. You know, if you thought that the banking sector, for example, was a, you know, potentially fragile, and you wanted to obscure or limit reporting in certain ways in order to give the impression the financial industry is more stable than it actually is, or isn't receiving funding, you could exempt right. them. And so we, you know, we don't have any idea how big this sort of, you know, all these unstated adjustments are in the federal government in terms of reporting, and we don't know who or how many companies receive the, you know, the exemptions from reporting.
One of the most extraordinary things I ever saw when we looked at FASB 56 was they sent the statement through the equivalent of a reg process and invited all the agencies to comment. And HUD said, oh, this is really good. We need this. And the question is, why does the domestic housing agency need secret books?
What but national security issue could possibly
right.
be related to housing and urban development?
So then we got, my favorite comment, though, was the SEC. So you're putting something through that essentially will render financial disclosure in the U.S. securities markets meaningless. Not 100%, but a, you know, more than a majority. And the U.S. Treasury market being the biggest bond market in the world. And the SEC's comment is no comment.
Yeah.
They had no comment. And you realized, okay, you know, this is how bad it's got. Okay, so let me just step back and look at the broad sweep. If you go to missingmoney.solari.com, we have your 2017 report, but then you've done a series of updates to that and grappled with these issues of, you know, how do you assess the situation given that the financial statements are no longer, from a practical standpoint, useful. And you've done several efforts to try and get more information. Tell us a little bit about what you've tried to do and what the results have been.
Well, one of the things I did was submit some FOIA requests so that we can get more detail on the nature of transactions, because the OIG report, for example, the 2015 report that indicated more than $6 trillion missing, unaccounted for, just gives you a summary. So you have to think to yourself, well, there must be a series of transactions that you could dig into. You know, this is what I would think should happen as well. Okay, there's, you know, $1 billion transaction. Well, how can that happen, right? And it's unaccounted for, or there's a, you know, no trail so that we can identify specifically what happened to those funds. And so I submitted a FOIA request, and they gave me some detail on the nature of these transactions. And so, you know, for example, you might end up with an $800 billion unsupported adjustment, you know, so, and then sometimes it's something coming in and something going out. And so it might be a $300 billion unaccounted for transaction of resources coming in, which is really difficult to explain, given that you have Treasury with an allocated amount that was determined by Congress to give to the Army.
Right.
You know, of, say, $200 billion. So how can you have an additional $300 billion transaction seemingly flowing in and then it flowing out? And, you know, so it might be $600 billion.
Right.
In and out. So you can't, from the descriptions, you can't know for sure what that is all about. It's vague, but at least you had more, and there were a number of them. So you could see, you know, these transactions, and they're enormous transactions, far in excess of the allocated budget for them.
Right. So in theory, they could be, you know, if you have the Army in the Middle East, they could be selling oil and laundering the money back in.
Right? Yeah, sure. You know, that would be a real feasible explanation, right? If you had, right. If you had a business or even a church or something with, you know, let's say a $400,000 budget, and then you had a transaction that was, you know, $1.2 million, and then you had, you know, that money coming in and then coming out, you know, you would think, well, an obvious explanation would be money laundering,
right?
Know, sort of undercover activity, but we can't know that from these reports. We can certainly say that's what it looks like.
Now, one of the questions I always get, well, wait a minute, if these guys are doing all this stuff, why would they allow these numbers to be recorded and published?
Yeah. Now, I asked that question to you.
Yeah. So I'm, and you know, what I believe is you have an entire bureaucracy that is paid to follow the process, and they need them to follow the process because, you know, you don't want everybody stealing, right? You want everybody following the process. And if you can design the financial statements so that nobody notices and nobody cares, you know, you need the bureaucrats to follow the process and just, you know, sort of follow the process and publish, you know, what they're doing. Need them to not be breaking the law for you. You don't want them to be in on the game.
I think that, I don't fully understand it, because if I were doing my job and I were one of the people tracking this, I would say, wow, there's something really weird going on. We should look into this. But maybe there are certain restrictions on your ability to say something if you're a government employee. I don't know the details. If I could draw a corollary to COVID, we have a vaccine adverse events reporting system in the United States.
Right.
And so you see that every year there are a certain number of injuries from vaccines. And then in 2020, when the COVID vaccine rolls out, you have this huge signal. It's just enormous signal. That should trigger some sort of inquiry or response, but it doesn't. And so right. In some sense, the CDC is doing its job, but the explanation is, well, we don't know for sure if these reported injuries are really actually caused by the vaccine. And of course, we also know that there's tremendous underreporting in that system. But, for people in the CDC, it doesn't seem to trigger a response. And for the life of me, I can't, I don't understand why.
It makes complete sense to me after what I saw at HUD, because the staff were very clear that they were not supposed to or couldn't look into certain things. And, by me coming in and demanding financial statements, there were a lot of very scared people. And, I'll never forget the first time when I got to HUD, I realized that the law said that the commissioner, my position, the assistant secretary of housing, was legally responsible as the sole fiduciary for the FHA funds. And the single family fund is required by law to be run on a self-supporting basis. So the first thing I did was, well, let me get my financial statements to see if I'm complying with the law or not. And what I discovered was that the financial statements were in the accounting department, who wouldn't talk to me because they reported to a different assistant secretary. And so it took me 2 months to lobby and get the accountants to moved over to report to me. And I said, I need to see a sources and uses of cash flows by district and HUD office about whether we're making or losing money. And they said, well, we don't have that. And I said, well, we mail out checks, so we should be able to see, some estimate of what we're doing. So they brought it in, and we were making money in 8 regions and losing money in 2 regions. And those 2 regions were losing more than all the money we were making. And the big one, of course, was the Texas region. And I called the head of the Texas region, who ran the housing departments, and I said, how do you think you did last year? And he said, oh, I think we about broke even. And I said, no, you lost $1.2 billion. He had no idea.
Wow.
Right. So I have many stories like that, and I could easily see how it happened. So at some point we hit a brick wall, because you can't know. I mean, at some point you don't have enough information. And I had Carolyn Betts, our general counsel, and I wrote an article called Caveat Emptor to try and help institutional investors and people investing in the treasury market to understand what was going on. Of course, the big one being our pension funds. So the U.S. pension funds are the biggest buyers of these securities. And essentially you're filling you're basically filling the pension funds up with paper in an operation they're financing assets which are disappearing out of the back door. And yet we've never been able to get the pension funds particularly interested in looking at this. One of the things we point out in the Caveat Emptor article is that there was an effort by Standard & Poor's to downgrade the U.S. government. And it resulted in literally the Department of Justice going after S&P and their holding company and almost destroying the company. And the real message since then is you're not allowed to downgrade the U.S. government's bond credit, no matter what they do.
Yeah, I received an email from a colleague a little while ago who also we're going to step into the question to some degree of COVID and academic censorship, but there's censorship broadly, right?
Right.
And I guess, Alexander, the email that he sent me had to do with some of the thoughts that Alexander Solzhenitsyn had. And Solzhenitsyn said something to the effect of the worst part of censorship is not redactions made to a document like we've experienced with, the Navy report, right, or in my case, a retraction of an article. It's that once you get the signal, you're going to be punished if you talk about these things or if you report on these things, then you stop writing those sentences because you know that it's going to be, you're going to be punished for doing so.
Right.
Or they'll be removed. And then, and this is the important part, is after a while you just stop thinking about it.
Right.
And so whether you're talking about financial statements and people just not talking about it, not writing about it, they might actually stop thinking about it.
So I always felt that it was important to keep covering the missing money because, and I liken it to the family, the man who has a family and then he goes and starts a family in another town and he's financing two families out of the same paycheck. And it's getting more and more uncomfortable. So at some point, he ditches the first family and goes with the second family and they're left high and dry. What I kept saying to you is, if we don't deal with this, they're going to continue to have to bring down life expectancy and they're going to have to, delay the retirement age or abrogate retirement contracts or depopulate. So if you look at the introduction to the missing money wrap-up that we wrote we published January 2019, it talks about the danger of moving into a real depopulation scenario, because if you're going to reset, how are you, you've made all these promises to hundreds of millions of people, and yet it appears you've moved the assets out that you need to address and keep those promises.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure what to say about that because it was seemingly prescient with what has happened during the COVID era. Our life expectancy started to drop before COVID and is accelerated after COVID, and not just right, because of COVID, but because of the policies and the vaccines.
Okay, so we go into the going direct reset. So after they've adopted FASB 56 in August 2019, the Federal Reserve, the G7 central bankers meet in Jackson Hole, and they vote on the going direct reset. And because they have to do a reset, right? This is not a sustainable situation. So off they go, and the pandemic begins. And before we start on the pandemic, I have always struggled with trying to find a way to make this, the federal government's refusal to obey the financial management laws. I've always seen this as unbelievably important, but I can't tell you, you have no idea what it's like to try and engage with people about something that they find absolutely boring.
I'm an economist.
but you from 2017 on, you've tried to engage people in understanding this and looking at it and dealing with it, but you've walked into the same force field that I've walked into.
Yeah, to some degree. I mean, I think there was a point at which when the accounting discrepancies equaled the total, reported debt, that seemed to get some traction in the media. And I had a colleague who had a connection with Forbes and wrote articles. So there was,
right,
it spilled its way in. Matt Taibbi wrote about it. And so there was spillover and it did get attention, but,
right,
but it, 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 the idea that accounting is super important. It is important, right? And people sort of take it for granted that we need to have the books right. But it, once you start talking about the details of it, there's sort of a glaze that, the significance of it doesn't always, sink in. And it's super important.
Right. Right. Okay. So the pandemic begins and the Fed injects $5 trillion, kicking off what will ultimately be some pretty significant inflation. And we start to see healthcare controls that are causing radical reengineering of the economy. So we're pumping up the stock market, we're pumping up crypto, and we're shutting down. So the insiders are flush with dough, and we're shutting down small business, small farms, and making it easy for the guys who are flush with dough to, grab the market share and buy everything. So you started to turn your attention to the fact that some of the healthcare policies made no sense, and you did one analysis on hydroxychloroquine, which was interesting, and then you did a wonderful survey on COVID and COVID-19 injections. So tell us a little bit about leaving the missing money for a second and starting to write and look at what in the world is going on in the pandemic.
Well, I think that a lot of us, and I really appreciate your sharing your thoughts in various venues and people like who are members of the Doctors for COVID Ethics Group, who are just articulating why these sort of global shutdowns don't make sense from a medical or health perspective. And so, at first when we started shutting everything down, we were all wondering, well, is this a real event? What's happening? How dangerous is it? And of course, we were told, well, we don't want to overwhelm the hospitals with sick people. So we want to slow flatten the curve a little bit. And so we're going to take 2 weeks and just stay home. And so we all said, well, okay, let's caution is one order. Let's see what happens. And then, as the weeks went on, it got extended and extended. But at the same time, we saw that there were certain population groups, the most vulnerable or the oldest and those who have other conditions, et cetera, and that young people were very resilient to all of this. And yet we kept the whole system shut down. And so then you start wondering, well, what is the real reason for the lockdowns? And it continued for so long. And of course, we could talk a long time about the multiple reasons for the lockdown, but one of them could be that given they were flooding the system and we don't know, where all that money went with certainty, but it only a small portion actually went to people who, right. Were out of work because of the lockdowns, et cetera. A much larger portion went somewhere else. And so was the purpose to sort of suppress the economy while they were flooding the system with funds? That's one layer of all of this. And another layer would be, well, the story began, well, there are no, effective treatments. There can't be. For the CDC to authorize the emergency use of a new treatment like this new gene therapeutic vaccine, you can't have another treatment that works. And so all of the guidance to the medical professionals was do nothing if you encounter somebody who has COVID, do nothing until finally they're so sick, they've got to go into the hospital, and then they give them treatments that don't help and are harmful.
Right.
And it was just a tragedy because it was clear that there were alternatives.
Right.
And there were many doctors who said, hey, we can treat this. And of course, they were suppressed. And a lot of people died because of lack of of effective treatment and the administration of treatments that were harmful.
So tell us about, you did an analysis with a colleague about estimating how many people were harmed by withholding hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah, so ACQ has been a very kind of a lightning rod, because there are some doctors who said, hey, this works. It's a treatment that is given for malaria and a variety of other conditions. And it, given in the right amount, is safe and can help. And so there were several doctors who said, we can use this to help save lives. But then the evidence was mixed. There was a study that was published in The Lancet, one of the premier medical journals, in which they said that this actually didn't help and was harmful. And then people started looking at the data and said, this doesn't make any sense. Where did this data come from? Is it fraudulent? You know, so questions were being asked, and then The Lancet retracted that paper. But all of the media around it said, oh, HCQ is not helpful, and it's dangerous. Don't use it. Stay away from it. And then when the paper was retracted, which it should have been in that case, it didn't circle back. Right. And so that there's this, still today, there's an overall view that HCQ is not an effective tool for treating COVID, which is false.
Right.
So my colleague and I wrote one paper and looked at it from a global perspective, because in certain countries where malaria is present, hydroxychloroquine is available over the counter.
Right.
And so, and everybody knows how to use it and treat in appropriate amounts of dosages. So you had a nice sort of experiment, because you had some places where HCQ was available over the counter, and you had some places like the United States who actually restricted its use and avoided it. So you could look at COVID fatalities and COVID infections and look. It's one way of looking at it, but see whether or not access to ACQ helped reduce COVID fatalities. And
right.
We provided evidence that it does. And so an estimate in the first year of COVID was that perhaps, according to the data on COVID fatalities, that if we had just made it accessible, we could have saved 100,000 lives if we had just made that treatment.
So I'm going to bring this back to the missing money, but before I do, I want to go next to your survey, because I remember we were on one call with Doctors for COVID Ethics, and we're talking about the discrepancy between what we were experiencing in the real world and the reports we were getting versus what the government was saying. And you said, oh, well, economists have a way of dealing with this when there's a discrepancy between the official statistics and sort of other forms of feedback. You do a survey.
It's one way to gather information. And you know what? For health data or health information, we can ask people about their experiences, and we do it all the time. So asking people about their health experiences or the health experiences of those they know and care about is not an uncommon thing. I had, with other colleagues, I had asked a question about a tornado event in Oklahoma. It was a National Science Funded project, and we were interested in examining whether or not having an experience with a tornado where somebody you know was harmed or killed, or somebody you mm-hmm. know had their home destroyed, whether that affected how you viewed the world, right? Changed your value structure, your risk preferences, etc. So we asked people about questions about whether they knew somebody who had died in the tornado, for example. Similarly, in another project, which was published in the sister journal of the paper that we're talking about, that was also published, we asked them about their experiences with prescription opioid misuse. and we asked, do you know of anybody within among your family and friends in your social circles who may have experienced an opioid issue or problem or challenge? And if so, what was it? So that paper was published. So, you know, these are perceptions. They're not precise, but it gives you an idea of what's happened and how people perceive it. So the idea was, is well, we have the signals in bears in the UK, you know, similar systems in the UK and Europe, you know, these large signals of adverse events occurring with COVID vaccine. And yet the clinical studies provided by Pfizer and Moderna show that these things are, you know, at least it was reported to have been safe. And so there's dissonance. What's happening? Is somebody not telling the truth? So another way to triangulate is to ask people what their experiences are. And you can't ask them directly, because if they were significantly harmed or perhaps died because of the vaccine, they will never answer the survey. So a good strategy is to ask about people they know and love. What is it right. that happened? That, you know, so the strategy in the survey that we're talking about was to ask people whether they know somebody who had a significant health event from, you know, health problems emerging from COVID illness, and if so, what was it? Kind of a general question, and we asked them to tell about the person they knew best who experienced this problem. So for the COVID illness, there were a lot of people said, well, you know, so-and-so died. So-and-so still has trouble breathing. They have scar tissue in their lungs because of the damage that occurred, et cetera. You know, so a lot of challenges there. But then there was an equivalent question, same wording, except for we replaced COVID illness with COVID vaccine. And there they had a chance to tell about the experiences in their family, you know, the person they knew best. And again, there were a lot of fatalities and a lot of things like blood clots, and one leg amputation, very troubling kinds of reports, right? And so so that gave us another point of triangulation.
And I remember reading the raw data in terms of what the reports they would give of what had happened to the person they knew the best who'd been injured or killed. And one of the reasons I valued that survey so much was it affirmed what I was hearing anecdotally. So I was getting tremendous amounts of reports of deaths and anecdotal harm, but I didn't know if it was representative. It could just be my network. And it wasn't until I saw the survey that I realized, okay, there is a significant problem. These injections are not safe and effective.
Yeah. So that was the goal at that time, was one, to see whether or not those experiences affected your decision about vaccination. So if you knew somebody who had experienced significant problems from COVID illness, that's kind of scary, right? So you're more likely to be vaccinated. But if you knew somebody who you thought experienced a vaccine injury, you're much less likely to be vaccinated because you saw them. And I think that's one reason why vaccination rates are going down, is because you have these personal experiences.
Right.
So that's one part. That part wasn't too controversial. And if I had left the report there, I think I wouldn't have gotten into the hot water that I'm in now. But because we had so many people report problems from in their social circles, of people who've been vaccinated, you could draw and make projections about potential nationwide fatalities or serious injuries. And so I tried to do that. And the estimate was, in the first year of vaccine rollout, as many as 280,000 people.
Right. And your survey was in the end of 2021. So that doesn't even include the next year.
Yeah, it was just the first year.
Right.
That paper was peer-reviewed and published in a journal called BMC Infectious Diseases, Biomedical Central, BMC Infectious Diseases, and several doctors and other medical professionals. Jordan Peterson tweeted about it, and it just went out everywhere. And of course, I think, you know, it wasn't just them. It was shared by others who said, you know, I know somebody
right
who had been harmed, and they're sharing it as well. So it just went like that. But of course, that resulted in a lot of pushback, and we can talk about that as well.
So I want to bring this back to the missing money. The injection program was run by the Department of Defense.
Yeah.
So we have the Department of Defense is missing $20 trillion from 1998 to 2015, and we have no idea what the amounts are subsequent to that. Just because
should we talk about the Bloomberg article very quickly?
Absolutely.
So in 2020, Bloomberg published an update on these accounting discrepancies. And in 2017, 18, and 19, a total of about $95 trillion in adjustments were made. But the article was vague whether or not they were unsupported or supported. In any case, it's difficult to imagine how a $700 billion DOD budget could translate into, say, $35 trillion in adjustments in 2019.
Right.
And so we saw that thanks to Rob Kirby. And we followed up. I actually asked for those reports, but in the new reports, there were no numbers given. So you couldn't see the nature of the adjustments. So we thought that $6 trillion was absurd. And now in 2019, it was $35 trillion of adjustments, of which we couldn't know whether or not they were supported or unsupported. But in any case, just incoherent. And so,
right.
So we have a lot of missing money, and to the point of absolute, we thought it was absurd before, and now it was really absurd.
Right. And we never, you know, I don't hear you use it, and I don't use it. I don't use the $94 trillion, because if they're not undocumentable, we just don't know what they are.
Yeah.
It's impossible to say. But yeah, here's to me, you know, you have an organization that owns and controls more weapons and satellites than any other organization in the world. It's missing $20 trillion plus another maybe $94 trillion, whatever the real number is. And it's implementing a mass atrocity against the American people. Do we think that's a coincidence?
I struggle to make sense of all of this, but I agree with you. The DOD is operating this vaccine rollout. They're instrumental in developing the technology. They're instrumental in making sure it's administered in a certain way. There are all kinds of psyops designed to compel people to be vaccinated, starting with sort of nudging to, you know, if you don't get vaccinated, you lose your job, you can't go to school, or, you know, all kinds of amazing coercion. And, you know, and it's an aside here, but I really struggle with why more people didn't push back against the coercion. Although there are many people who have and very courageous. And clearly now we have the signals that these vaccines, if you want to call them a vaccine, have caused great harm.
Right.
And COVID, you know, even, you know, we can have linkages back to the creation of some sort of hybrid COVID virus that appears to be connected to DoD as well. And so you start linking all these pieces together, and you know, it's not unreasonable to conclude what you just said.
Right. If I had stolen $21 trillion of your money and I didn't want to give it back, you know, I wouldn't necessarily want you in a position to ask questions or demand it back.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Right. The best defense is a good offense. That's what I think.
Well, it's all very troubling.
Right.
Here we
are. So let me turn to the push for financial repression, because the question is, if you're the leadership, you know, there is a reason you might want total control through the financial system right now. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so.
So I
want to preface it that I shared a recent report with you about trust, you know, generally within the United States, and it just continues to fall. And once you lose faith in each other and faith in the system, then they lose control.
Right.
And so I think we're sort of at this inflection point of you know, enough people being coming to realize what we're talking about is happening and being very troubled and losing faith.
Right.
And so once that happens, you either need to reestablish faith by being upfront and moving forward in a way that is actually in the interests of people, or you have to impose greater control. And I think what we're seeing is an imposition of greater control.
Right. And so that's CBDCs. So if you look at sort of where we are, we have way too much debt as a result of these financial policies. We have serious inflation as a result of injecting the $5 trillion plus into the economy. I think the trust is contributing to a slowdown, as is some of the policies to control the food supply. And we see war in the Ukraine and more war around the world. You know, one way establishments have gotten out of these kinds of problems in the past is to go to war.
Yeah.
And DOD is the leading organization that goes to war, correct?
That's right.
Yep. So one of the analysis we published was a wrap-up on taxation and what citizens could do, because I think, to me, this comes down to taxation without representation. So right now, whether we're buying treasuries in our pension fund or we're paying our taxes, we're financing this.
We're financing it. You know, well, we're helping to finance it. There may be other sources of revenue financing it as well.
Right, clearly. So what do you think we should do?
I don't know. I think as trust diminishes, more people are aware. And we do see individual states starting to push back against some of the policies. And, you know, for example, you have suggested that at the state level or subnational level, we could create hold tax funds back and then only administer them to the federal government for those activities which have been authorized.
Right.
And, you know, I have trouble fully seeing how that would be implemented, but in somehow, some way, we need to take control of those tax dollars and administer them to the government in a way that it only enables them to do the things that they've been authorized to do. There's, tremendous risk of major disruption in anything that happens, and so we have to be willing to incur the costs and instability associated with making huge changes. But those are the kinds of things that need to happen.
So the most optimistic thing that has happened to me over the last year is I've had the chance to talk to legislators from about four or five state legislative bodies. And it's remarkable because you're talking about people who are deeply competent. They understand the economy at a local level and they understand the economy at the state level. I mean, they really have a lot of experience and depth. They're smart and they're competent and they really care about their constituencies. So they went into public service because they were concerned that something was wrong. They wanted to do something about it. So you've got, you know, they're smart enough and they're competent enough and they have the right intention. Their problem has been they just couldn't believe it was really this bad. But what's amazing when you get a group of them together and they realize, oh, you know, we can't count on this system. And we also have to make sure that we're not cornered and we, the state, lose our financial transaction freedom. You know, because the danger is the state and local governments are going to lose their financial transaction freedom along with the citizens.
Yes.
And so, and you know, here's the funny thing. If you talk to the smart guys, and there are a lot of smart guys in this system, they realize the problem is not just that the federal government might or the Fed might control their financial transaction freedom. They know the federal government could mess up and just start to unravel. In other words, they're not just worried about tyranny. They're worried about gross incompetency.
You know, I was having a conversation with one of my colleagues who works in Michigan government. And I'm sort of a risk guy. I do natural disaster research as well. And just as an illustration, in Florida, where there are regular hurricanes that come through, most households have some water, some extra food, a generator, you know, things you need in case the power goes out for a week or so, you know, while they're cleaning up after a hurricane. In California, they're subject to earthquakes, which happen very rarely, not very often. And even those households that are on, you know, a fault line and are most vulnerable really don't prepare because it happens so infrequently. And so what I was trying to say, talk with him about is, well, here we are, we have a federal government. At some point, you know, we've talked about this in other venues, but with rising interest rates, interest payments on the debt are approaching $1 trillion a year.
Right.
This past year, deficit spending was $2 trillion. So we're over $31 trillion in total debt and continuing to grow. We all know that this is unsustainable, and this is only the part that we know about or is reported. So I was saying, how do we help government at the state level prepare for the possibility of a major disruption at the federal level? What if they stop making payments?
Right.
What if something, a major disruption occurs? Can the state function on its own? Is it prepared like households in Florida are prepared for a disruption?
Right.
Or like California?
It doesn't have to. So if you look at the disruption list, it doesn't have to be that the federal credit completely unravels. It can simply be because the market share of the dollar is falling, inflation is going up and up. I mean, if you look at the Chapman Index at price of good, you know, household inflation is at 18% in Ohio and Chicago.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, so it goes up and up. But the other thing is, if you get in certain kind of war situations, you can have the grid go down in some areas or all of the country for some period of time. You can have all sorts of, you know, you could get in certain places civil unrest. There are all sorts of disruptions. It's not just the big bang, we lose the reserve currency.
Yeah, and, you know, so my inquiry to this official was, should we start thinking about having some sort of contingency plan, like we would for natural disasters, if there were a major disruption of some sort, including one that emerges from financial problems.
Right.
He, you know, the response was, is yes, we probably should, but it's hard to go there because now you're questioning the you know, you're questioning the competence of the federal government to continue operations, and that's a place that politicians don't want to go. Or some politicians don't want to go.
I don't know. How do we make it possible in the next, you know, we're coming into a campaign season where people are going to start talking about this. But I can see why a politician might not want to say it on TV, but I can see why the people who run a state administration know they have to do this. They have to be prepared.
I think some are thinking about it and preparing for it.
Oh, I think they are too. I think they are too. So that's what, if you look at what you can do, one of the things we can all do, of course, is roll back the digital systems by using cash and getting more analog throughout our life. But the other thing we can do is, coming into the campaign season, I'm seeing great, great people at the state level and local level run for office. And some of them are talking about these things. They're talking about a constitutional crisis. They're talking about, how do we prepare? How do we make sure we protect our individual or state sovereignty? And, you know, I just think if each one of us picks out a few local or state people to get to know and support, it can make an enormous difference.
And the thing that may open up conversation about all these things is Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s promise to tell the truth to the American people. You know, I think there's a lot of suppression happening in the mainstream media regarding the comments he's making. But so far, he's telling the truth about a lot of it.
I have to say this. After watching his speech, he gave a 2-hour speech at his launch, and I thought it was excellent. I mean, just absolutely excellent. But afterwards, I called because there were certain things he wouldn't touch.
Yeah.
So, and that's not a criticism. I understand exactly why he's doing it. But I called John Rappaport and I said, would you do a Solari report with me called The Things We're Not Allowed to Talk About at the Cocktail Party? And that's why I wrote a piece on the Second Amendment and sent it to Bobby and his team, because I said, look, you know, this, you know, where I come from, you know, this is the wedge issue. Yeah. This has got to be dealt with. And because I think, you know, where I live, if they get gun control, we're dead.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, for me, and for my neighbors, it's a life and death issue as a practical matter. And that makes it very hard for anyone who's facing, you know, literally organized crime with a gun at their head, supporting anybody who's not firmly and strongly in support of the Second Amendment.
Did you get a response?
Yeah, so his team says he supports the Constitution and the Second Amendment. What a lot of people will tell you is, if I vote for a Democratic candidate, I'm going to get a wealth of other people coming in, and then they'll have a critical mass, you know, to push it the wrong way, and that's a legitimate issue. You know, the way to deal with it, if you're a federal candidate, is to say, look, ultimately, this is a state issue. But it is constitutional. What is, you know, the focus of the people who want central control right now is to chip away at it with red flag laws.
Yeah.
And the problem is, if you give the government the ability to say that somebody's dangerous, everybody's dangerous that they want to suppress. You know, it's one thing to give a power to a government. It's another to give it to a criminal organization that lies every day.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the challenge.
It is a challenge.
Anyway, so I'm with you. I want to have a great big conversation. And that's why I want to take the $21 trillion plus the $94 trillion, whatever it is, and throw it right into the middle of the table, because unless you address and deal with this issue, there are no solutions.
You can't allow, I mean, I agree. You don't have a representative democracy and a rule of law if you have all of this happening and people just shrug their shoulders. We have to somehow address it. And the first way is to let people know that this is happening.
Right. If they have the power to steal all of our assets, we will have no assets. And when the World Economic Forum says it's 2030 and you have no assets, you know, that's what they mean. Because they are stealing your assets. And if we don't stop it, we will have no assets. So this comes down to basically, you know, I hate to say it, for me, it's a war. Somebody's trying to kill you and steal all your assets. So the question is, how are we going to stop it? And it starts.
I have come to that conclusion too. I think we're in a war. I do. Mm-hmm. And it's a different kind of war.
It's an asymmetrical war. And so I want to end on a positive note because, you know, I think in an asymmetrical war, so rather than the enemy saying, look, you know, we want to depopulate you and take your stuff, they're not going to say that. What they're going to do is come up with 5,000 ways of attacking that relate to transgender and LGBTQ. And, you know, now in California, they've created a hotline where you can call and report your neighbor for hate speech. So if your neighbor gets mad at you about what you're doing in the yard, they can call and report you to, you know, the governor for hate speech. Anyway, so but they attack you on all these things that are just, you know, they're like flack, right? But they take up your time. They turn people against each other. They keep you discombobulated, you know, because if you're trying to steal their money, you know, you keep them embroiled and all this other stuff. It's asymmetrical warfare. Now, what I've always said to everybody is, look, there's one place where we have them. It's like Al Capone in the taxes. We can get him on taxes. We can get these guys on violating the financial management laws. This is a no-brainer. This is documented with government documents. We can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that these guys have violated all these laws, including in criminal ways. It's proved. It's a hard case. Why don't we just go after them? You know, I used to tell everybody, stop fighting with the school board on COVID-19. Go do an audit of their books and go get them on the money. Wherever they're, you know, they broke the law on the money. They always do. You know, go get them, you know, just do the Al Capone taxes. Let's get them on the taxes. Don't get them on the murder and the homicide. It's all too hard. Just get them on the taxes. So I've never understood, why can't we go get them on the missing money? This seems to me to be pretty obvious.
Yeah, I think that's a useful strategy. And I think it is a way to get at diminishing the amount of power these entities or people, whoever they are, have. But that, you know, again, with all the other challenges, there is the question of rule of law. And can we use the rule of law to implement the actual law and then prosecute and then get change?
Well, I think we should send an invoice to the New York Fed and the BIS and say, you owe us $21 trillion. Now, the question is how we enforce.
Yeah. So that's the question, is how do we enforce, and can we find a way for the rule of law to be used in our favor in this regard? And I think that's the challenge, because we've seen so much of the rule of law just not apply to some entities.
Right. So to me, this comes down to the state AGs, although I will just once again tell the story. I did get my... You know, when the litigation ended, it was only $14,000 per person. You know, I hadn't met you, so it hadn't skyrocketed to $21 trillion yet, but it was just $14,000 per person. And I had a credit card debt to one of the New York Fed member banks, in fact, the one that has the largest equity ownership, according to the last disclosure. And so I owed them $14,000. So the settlement money came in, and I wrote them a letter. And I said, you know, I owe you $14,000, but you owe me $14,000 because you're responsible as one of the owners for the New York Fed for $14,000 per person missing. So I'm asserting a common law right of offset, and I'm tearing up your $14,000 because you owe me $14,000. So we'll just call it a day. And if you have a problem with that, here's the name and number for my attorney, you know, and let's negotiate from there. I never heard a word, and they wrote it off.
Wow.
Right. So now I don't recommend anybody do that unless you have a good attorney and you're ready to have a long, big fight. But, you know, if you can get enough people together, you know, if you owe JP Morgan Chase, Citibank, or any of the other members of the New York Fed money, get ready, you know, please feel free to organize and hire yourself a great attorney and go at it. So I'd love to see the student loan guys do the same thing. So anyway, so there are ways to enforce. We discuss all of them in our taxation wrap up. Well, Mark, I appreciate you doing this because my prediction is, are you ready for this? Over the next, between now and the end of the campaign in 2024, I think that the missing money issue is finally going to get interesting.
I'm optimistic too. And yeah. When we were talking about doing this interview, I thought the theme is really transparency, and whether there's rule of law or not, we can show and increase transparency and more people become aware of this and other shenanigans, then, the game kind of stops, right?
Right.
If you know the risks from the vaccine, you're not going to take the shot.
Right. And
if you know there's missing money, then you know the game and you're going to change your behavior. And right. So I think transparency is the key to change.
Right. Secrecy is what's poisoned our society.
Yeah.
And, you know, I keep coming back to my pastor's expression, if we can face it, God can fix it. So I'm with you. Transparency, but I would really appreciate a great core of state legislators in all 50 states.
Sure.
Anyway, so Dr. Mark Skidmore, a true scholar, I can't tell you how much we appreciate your work. And, you keep finding the world amazing as you dig for the truth, but nothing stops you. You keep digging for the truth. So tell people how to find your wonderful website and how to stay in touch with your work.
Sure. I post regularly on my website, which is mark-skidmore.com, mark-skidmore.com. It's called Lighthouse Economics. And I do some of my own writing. And sometimes I just share articles that I think are important or of relevance. So you can find me there, and then you'll find me every once in a while, talking with Catherine. And thanks for all of your work, Catherine. I really have appreciated your all that you've done. And it's been so helpful to me.
And we have all of the documents up at missingmoney.solaria.com, including the financial documents that go up and down on the on the U.S. government website. Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for joining us on Financial Coup d'Etat, Missing Money for Beginners. Thank you for sticking with this story, which I think is right at the heart of real solutions. So I appreciate your taking the time to listen and to understand. Have a wonderful day.